gentlemen, I'm only passing through. People are crazy and times are strange. I'm locked inside my brain.
Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is Mike down here in Arizona land. Your mind is your primary weapon. Today's date is the 21st of May, 2018. It's a Monday. And you're tuned in to Liberty Tree Radio. Continue our broadcast today about protracted war, the popular forces versus the regular armies, and the guerrilla as a missionary. A little bit about Mao Zedong and the lessons of China. My email address is altabib762@hotmail.com. altabib762@hotmail.com. I have a couple of border news items. And thanks for taking the time to tune in today. And thank you for helping support Liberty Tree Radio. As always, we dedicate this broadcast to Lily Grace Antoinette. And also, now or later in this broadcast, you're more than welcome to call in. And telephone is 712-432-0900. 712-432-0900. 0900. And once you get there, it'll ask you for the room number, and that's 957-464, and then the pound sign. 957-464, and the pound sign. And your phone will be muted, and then press star 6 to unmute your phone. Say your piece, and then you can push star 6 to remute your telephone. Let's see. Also, being that we have a limited amount of time here on Liberty Tree Radio, also have a broadcast over on the Micro Effect on Thursdays and Fridays starting at the same time. But it's 2 hours each day from 8 a. to 10 a. Arizona time. Or starting, the last couple of weeks have been hinting around about where we were going in our study and compiled quite a bit of information discussing unconventional warfare and the parts and pieces, the current thinking of the United States government in combining the Army Special Operations Force, the State Department, the media, and all the parts to wage successful unconventional war, and the parts and pieces and the differentiation between unconventional, irregular, conventional war, foreign internal defense, counterinsurgency, insurgency, and how to differentiate between the two, because sometimes the meanings can get a little blurred on that part. Also, talking about the United States power projection on those parts. Now, there's a couple of reasons why I bring this study, these blocks of instruction. Number one, obviously, is to understand where the government is coming from. And sometimes it's too easy to put it in a context of Iraq and Afghanistan and should we or shouldn't we be there and, you know, and all this, what does it matter, et cetera, et cetera. And then you shut your mind off to the information. So that's one aspect of it. And the other aspect of it is to do some self-examination, a proper after-action review for your training and your group, and look at things that have happened here in the last 4 years or so with the Patriot Movement and how ill-prepared that they were for the expected propaganda war against the Bundys in Nevada or the Bundys in Oregon and the aftermath of those, because there was a lot of poor leadership, no training, no planning, no intelligence preparation of the battlefield, no organization, nothing. And it's doing the same thing over and over again. So I bring you these lessons so you can evaluate an after-action review of your training and cross-check them with the current doctrine from the United States on how they address these, because they all are already in place on what they are prepared to do and the inner workings between the State Department and the military and the Department of Defense and the media and all these other issues. And whether you choose to try to branch off into some of these other parts, that'll be up to you, but another branch of this is to be aware of this is what is to be expected. So, also these two different broadcasts, the one here on Liberty Tree Radio and the one that's on the Micro Effect, it's kind of, well, there I know that there are people out there that listen to both broadcasts. but there are some people that are unaware of one or the other and try to get the word out. And I noticed that there are new listeners, so it's important to help bring the new listeners up to speed on the Thursday and Friday broadcast. And it's also good to reinforce. I don't necessarily particularly care about repeating myself, but sometimes to drive the point home, to be a little redundant, that sometimes can be beneficial. But when we talk about protracted war and the popular forces versus the regular armies, kind of exactly what we're talking about in unconventional warfare, because revolutionary wars, well, they're generally, of necessity, wars of long duration. And the seeds of the revolution are slow to germinate. The roots and the tendrils spread out silently underground, long before there's any signs of a sprout or a bud. Then suddenly, one day, like new wheat springing up in a cultivated field, there's a blaze of color, an overnight growth, and the rebels are there and everywhere. Now, it's customary to speak of guerrilla wars as wars of attrition. The phrase is not perfectly accurate. Guerrilla warfare is not so much abrasive as subversive. It is a growth that permeates the crevices of a rotting structure and one day bursts it asunder. Yet attrition does, after all, play a great part. In the political sphere, the government is subjected to a constant wearing pressure that comes from the great expense and anxiety of the anti-guerrilla campaign and from the constant cry of the opposition, the banks, the business community. When will it end? And what are you doing about it? Now, economic attrition has always been discussed. Sabotage is one aspect of it. The loss of credit and investments suffered by a country engaged in a civil war is another. Far more important is, and that no small nation and few great ones can stand the deprivation indefinitely. Yet the painful fact is that the guerrillas, for their part, can carry on indefinitely, Iraq and Afghanistan. And having no vested interest, no political opposition within their own ranks, no economic problems under those, other than those that can be solved by extending the war and capturing what they need, the insurgents have nothing to lose and everything to gain by continuing the struggle. And on the other hand, they have nothing to gain and everything to lose by giving up. In fact, once the banner of rebellion has been raised and the blood has been shed, it's no easy matter to give up. The rebels begin to fight for whatever reason, and they continue because they must. They fight then in order to survive, and given their inferiority of resources, they can survive only by avoiding direct confrontation with the superior enemy, that is, battle on the enemy's terms. And guerrilla strategy is dictated from the start by this consideration. And the result, if the guerrillas are to be successful and to avoid extermination, it is a protracted war. The conflict must continue until the movement has recruited and trained enough men and come into possession of enough arms to build a revolutionary army capable of defeating the regular army in open battle. And failing that, it must continue until political developments resulting from the campaign have brought about the desired end, the rising of the masses of the people, and the overthrow or abdication of the discredited government. In Cuba, the Batista regime collapsed before the military confrontation had fully developed. The army, lacking leadership, its general staff gone, found no reason to continue the struggle and surrendered. A general strike in Havana, in other words, a rising of the people, was sufficient to make it clear to the military that there would be no further purpose in fighting. Batista had fled, and his designated heirs could not be forced on the rebellious country. Nothing but a revolutionary government would he accept it. Cuba is a prototype, and it's typical of the dependent semi-colonial countries in which revolution can be attained without the bloody necessity of full-scale war. And in those countries, it will be sufficient, barring intervention by the dominating colonial power, to create, by guerrilla warfare, the conditions in which a discredited government, discredited because it can no longer keep order and assure a profit to the country's proprietors, and then it falls from the lack of support, and the revolutionaries rush in to fill the political vacuum. And all of the Central American dependencies of the United States and most of the South American republics, economic and political satellites of the United States, are in the same category as Cuba. Their governments can see the handwriting on the Cuban wall, and so can Washington. And hence the almost hysterical efforts of the past years to isolate Cuba, to keep the infection from spreading. Because if it does spread, and there is evidence that it's already happened to some extent, that may be expected to go the way of Cuba. And however, to say so is to assume that the United States will not intervene militarily. Intervention would create an entirely new picture. And one could expect to see Indochina recreated in Latin America, and revolutionary shortcuts a la Cuba would be out. And the remaining colonies of the European powers are in another category. And who here is a political solution can obviate the necessity of a military showdown. But yet, in the case of the actual colonies, it will not be a matter of discrediting the colonial powers or its government, but simply of taking the profit and prestige out of colonialism. Cyprus provides a good example of an insurgency that was successful simply because terror, sabotage, and constant disorder made the island too unprofitable and politically embarrassing for the British to maintain and remain. They got out, finally, not because that they were forced out, because that there was no longer any compelling reason to remain, and there are many good reasons for withdrawing. Now, in the third category are those revolutionary wars that must be won at last on the battlefield. And China is a classic example, the laboratory in which principles were evolved that are still being proven today in all the backward areas of the world. A popular revolutionary forces can defeat regular armies. And this is the fundamental lesson of China. Popular forces, to put the matter more precisely, can become armies, making the transition from guerrilla activity to mobile warfare that will be superior on their own ground to regular troops equipped with all the heavy weapons produced by modern industry. So how can a nation that is not industrialized defeat one that is? This, says former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State E.L. Katzenbach Jr., is the problem that confronts Mao Zedong, an answer which applies to insurgency anywhere, as against the mechanized army, is guerrilla warfare. As Katzenbach sees it, Mao's approach to the theory of war as applies to his own peculiar situation and that of China was simply to shift the emphasis customarily given to the fundamental components of the previous military doctrine, where the industrial nation stretched such tangible military factors as arms, logistics, and manpower, says Katzenbach. Mao looked to the intangibles, time, space, and will. Now, lacking the arms with which to confront well-equipped armies in the field, Mao avoided battle by surrendering territory, and in doing so, he traded space for time and used the time to produce will, the psychological capacity of the Chinese people to resist defeat. And this is the essence of guerrilla war. Now, although Mao never stated it quite the way that Katzenbach said, the basic premise The theory is that political mobilization may be substituted for industrial mobilization with a successful military outcome. And that's to say, his fundamental belief is that only those who will admit defeat can be defeated. So if the totality of the population can be made to resist surrender, the resistance can be turned into a war of attrition, which will eventually and inevitably be victorious. And the context brings to mind the well-known quotation from Mao, "With the common people of the whole country mobilized, we shall create a vast sea of humanity and drown the enemy in it." And as for the time factor, Katzenbach observes, Mao holds that military salvation stems from the political conversion, but note, conversion takes time. So Mao's military problem was how to organize space so that it could be made to yield to time. And his political problem was how to organize time so that it could be made to yield will, and that quality makes the willingness to sacrifice the order of the day and the ability to bear suffering cheerfully the highest virtue. So Mao's real military problem was not that of getting the war over with. The question to which Western military thinkers have directed the greater part of their attention, but that of keeping it going. Now, Mao's problem then, how to avoid a military decision? His answer, hit and run, fight and live to fight another day. Give away before the determined advance of the enemy, and like the sea, close in again as the enemy passes. And the formula, space for time, is well conceived. But in his selected military writings, Mao makes it clear that nothing is gained unless the time is used to produce political results by raising the revolutionary consciousness, the will of the masses. When the Red Army fights, it fights not merely for the sake of fighting, but to agitate the masses, to organize them, and to help them establish revolutionary political power apart from such objects. Fighting loses its means and the Red Army the reason for its existence. Now, Mao believes that Revolutionary War itself is the university in which guerrilla fighters are schooled, and that war develops its own lessons and principles. Our chief method is to learn warfare through warfare. A person who has had no opportunity to go to school can learn warfare. He can learn through fighting a war. A revolutionary war is a mass undertaking. It is often not a matter of first learning and then doing, but of doing and then learning, for doing itself is learning. There is a gap between the ordinary civilian and the soldier, but it is no great wall, and it can be quickly closed. And the way to close it is to take part in revolution, in war. Now, political mobilization, and that is raising the level of political consciousness of the people and involving them actively in the revolutionary struggle, is the first task of the guerrillas. And it is the nature of this effort which necessarily takes time, and that accounts for the protracted character of the Revolutionary War. The study of Mao, however, discloses something more. Time is required, not alone for political mobilization, but to allow the inherent weaknesses of the enemy to develop under the stress of war. Mao makes this point more than once in his military writings, in several different contexts. In the Sino-Japanese War, for example, Japan, an industrial power, had the great advantage of the superior war machine, capable of striking devastating blows at the poorly armed troops of semi-feudal, semi-colonial, unindustrial China. Yet such an advantage, unless immediately decisive, could not compensate for defeats that would become apparent in prolonged conflict. The first of those was that Japan, while powerful militarily, lacked the base in neutral resources and manpower to sustain her war machine. As far from home and in a vast populous country over a long period of time. Now, indeed, the war had been started to compensate for the defect, but extended through conquest Japan's lack of material resources. And insofar as this was true, war was an act of desperation and a contradiction, putting the cart before the horse. For what would happen if the war was not won quickly and the new wealth quickly absorbed and exploited? Because Japan was seeking, of necessity, a war of quick decision, and the correct military response was to deny it by avoiding a military confrontation and fighting along the lines of the guerrilla and the mobile warfare, trading the vast space of China for the time necessary, one, to let the inherent weakness of Japan develop and show themselves under the stress of a protracted war, and two, to build Chinese resistance forces to the strength and the degree of the organization needed to confront the gradually weakened Japanese war machine. And as Mao analyzed the situation, quote, Japan's war is conducted on the basis of her great military, economic, and political organization power, but at the same time it rests on an inadequate natural endowment. Japan's military, economic, and political organization power is great, but quantitatively inadequate. Japan is a comparatively small country, deficient in manpower and in military, financial and military and material resources, and she cannot stand a prolonged war. And Japan rulers are endeavoring to resolve the difficulty through war, but again, they will get the very reverse of what they desire. That is to say, the war they have launched to resolve this difficulty will end in adding to it and even in exhausting Japan's original resources. Now, other defects were apparent. The internal and external contradictions of Japanese imperialism have driven it not only to embark on an adventurous war unparalleled in scale, but also to approach its final collapse. In terms of development, Japan is no longer a thriving country. The war will not lead to prosperity sought by her ruling class, but to the very reverse, the doom of Japanese imperialism. This is what we mean by the retrogressive nature of Japan's war. It is this reactionary quality, coupled with the military feudal character of Japanese imperialism, that gives rise to the peculiar barbarity of Japan's war, all of which will arouse the utmost the class antagonism within Japan, the antagonism between the Japanese and the Chinese nations, and the antagonism between Japan and most other countries of the world. While Japan can get international support from the fascist countries, the international opposition she is bound to encounter will be greater than her international support. This opposition will gradually grow and eventually will not only cancel out support, but even bear down on Japan itself. To sum up, Japan's advantage lies in her great capacity to wage war, and her disadvantage lies in the reactionary and barbarous nature of her war, in the inadequacy of her manpower and material resources, and in her meager international support. Now, against the Japanese war-making capacity were pitted the Chinese advantages of space, time, and will. And the long struggle for national liberation, as Mao notes, had tempered the Chinese people. Social and political gains had created a will that was capable of great sacrifice and resistance over long periods of time. And, again, by contrast with Japan, China is a very big country with vast territory, rich resources, a large population, and plenty of soldiers, and is capable of sustaining a long war. Space in which to maneuver, abundant manpower, strong international support, and the Chinese will to resist aggression. These were China's advantages, and they were also the reasons for avoiding a quick decision in favor of a protracted war, one in which Japan's single advantage, superior arms and organization, would be worn away. It can be seen that Japan has great military, economic, and political organizational power, but that her will is reactionary and barbarous. Her manpower and material resources are inadequate, and she is in an unfavorable position internationally. China, on the contrary, has less military, economic, and political organization power, but she is in her era of progress. Her war is progressive and just. She is, moreover, a big country, a fact which enables her to sustain a protracted war, and she will be supported by most countries. The above are the basic, mutual, contradictory characteristics of the Sino-Japanese War. They have determined and are determining the protracted character of the war and the fact that the final victory will go to China and not to Japan. The war is a contest between these characteristics. They will change in the course of war, each according to its own nature, and from this everything else will follow. Now, similar considerations determined the protracted character of the struggle against the warlords and later the Kunmintang during China's long civil war. And in analyzing the Chinese situation, Mao notes the contradictions and the conflicts of interest that arise on several planes. For example, between the various imperialist powers seeking dominance in China, within the Chinese ruling classes, and between the ruling classes on one hand and the broad masses of the people on the other. Number one, conflict amongst the warlords and against the nationalist government creates a heavier burden of taxation. Number two, heavier taxation causes the landlord class to extract more exorbitant rents from the peasants and increases the hatred for the latter for the warlords. Number three, the backward conditions of Chinese industry as related to foreign industry and foreign concessions in China causes a more vicious exploitation of Chinese labor and drives the wedge deeper between the workers and the Chinese bourgeoisie. And number four, because of the pressure of foreign goods, the exhaustion of the purchasing power of the workers and the peasant masses, and then the increase in government taxation, more and more dealers in China-made goods and independent producers are being driven to bankruptcy because the reactionary government, though short of provisions and funds, endlessly expands its armies and thus constantly expands the warfare. The masses of the soldier are in the constant state of privation. And because of the growth in government taxation, the rise in rent and interest demanded by the landlords, and the spread of the disaster of war, there are famine and banditry everywhere, and the peasant masses and the urban poor can hardly keep alive. And because the schools have no money, many students fear that their education may be interrupted because production is backward. Many graduates have no hope of employment. Now, Mao's conclusion, quote, "Once we understand all these contradictions, we shall see in what a desperate situation, in what a chaotic state China finds herself. We shall also see that the high tide of revolution against the imperialists the warlords and the landlords is inevitable, and there will come and will come very soon. All China is littered with dry faggots, which will soon be aflame. The saying, a single spark can start a prairie fire, is an apt description of how the current situation will develop. We need only look at the strikes by the workers, the uprising by the peasants, the mutinies of soldiers, and the strikes of students, which are developing, to see that it cannot be long before a spark kindles a prairie fire. Now, in his theory of guerrilla warfare, whether against domestic or foreign enemies, Mao distinguishes carefully the various phases of development of the campaign, laying particular emphasis on the first phase, which he calls the period of strategic defensive. Now, in the beginning, and the first phase may last for many months, territory is nothing. Attrition is everything. The enemy is permitted, even encouraged, to expand where he will. The guerrillas give ground, conducting only harassing action, circling around, fighting always in the enemy's rear, and presenting no continuous force for the foe to smash. The enemy is engaged during this period in the strategic offensive with the objective of wiping out the guerrillas. Now, on his part, the action is characterized by a series of encirclement and suppression campaigns compared to so-called clear-and-hold efforts of South Vietnam or Iraq and Afghanistan under American leadership, during which the effort is made to occupy territory and to rid it of the guerrilla infestation piecemeal. Now, the contradiction implicit in that effort is that it converts increasingly large parts of the national territory into government rear areas where guerrilla operations work best. The repressive forces succeed in circling areas of the guerrilla activity, and no one stops them. But in the process, they themselves become encircled by guerrillas, and while the guerrillas can almost always slip out of any given encirclement by dispersion and exfiltration, how can the army slip out? Where is the front? It does not exist. Movements of men and material become progressively greater and more expensive. The lines of supply and communication become even longer, more attenuated, and more vulnerable to guerrilla attack. In effect, the army, in occupying broad expanses of rural territory, abets the guerrillas by providing them with broader and easier targets and more accessible sources of arms and ammunition. And the guerrilla strategy remains constant during this period, although tactics vary with the situation. Now, the strategy is to force the enemy to spread himself as thin as possible by harassing him all along the line, wherever he is weak, and then to concentrate all available guerrilla strength to annihilate, never merely to rout inferior enemy units one at a time. Ours are guerrilla tactics, writes Mao. They consist mainly of the following points. 1. Divide our forces to arouse the masses. Concentrate our forces to deal with the enemy. 2. The enemy advances, we retreat. The enemy camps, we harass. The enemy tires, we attack. The enemy retreats, we pursue. 3. To extend stable base areas, employ the policy of advancing in waves, then pursued by a powerful enemy, employ the policy of circling around. 4. Arouse the greatest numbers of the masses in the shortest time by the best possible methods. These tactics are just like casting a net. At any moment, we should be able to cast it or draw it in. We cast it wide to win over the masses and draw it in to deal with the enemy. Now, in areas where little opposition is met, the net is cast. the guerrillas dispersed to carry on the work of political indoctrination, to strengthen the internal economy of the revolutionary movement, to establish rear base areas, bases which, it would be noted, can be expanded or contracted or even abandoned on short notice. Where opposition is strong, the net is drawn in. The guerrillas are able to concentrate heavy forces. Mao recommends 2 or 4 or even 6 times the enemy's strength against the single enemy's weak point. Battles are not prolonged. On the contrary, it is Mao who has invented the 5-minute attack. It consists of a sudden onslaught, a brief and furious interval of fighting, and then the assault is broken off as suddenly as it began, and the guerrillas rapidly retreat, having inflicted many casualties and taken many arms as possible during the stated time, but not lingering even a minute or more. Now, Mao stresses the battle of quick decision, the very opposite of weapon or Western military strategy, where the enemy, backed by heavy industry, is able to make a long-drawn technological contest of each battle, relying on superiority of equipment and logistics to tell in the end. Now, the guerrillas must rely on speed, superior position, and locally superior manpower, and must break off the engagement before the superior of heavy weapons can take its toll. As we have remarked before, the guerrilla fights the war of the flea. The flea bites, hops, and bites again, nimbly avoiding the foot that would crush it. He does not seek to kill his enemy at a blow, but to bleed him and feed on him, to plague and to bedevil him, to keep him from resting and to destroy his nerves and his morale. All of this requires time. Still more time is required to breed more fleas. What starts as a local infestation must become an epidemic, as one by one their areas of resistance link up, like spreading ink spots on a blotter. Now we're starting to wrap our mind around guerrilla warfare and some of these principles, the war of the flea. So oftentimes I'm asked about what it is and how it's done and what's the best part. But in today's broadcast, we can clearly see that these principles do exist. There's no sense in trying to reinvent the wheel. But notice it was the 5-minute attack. It wasn't everybody going up here for a month up at the Bundy Ranch or going and occupying some visitor center in the middle of nowhere. And I remember some of the first interviews, I think it was Ammon Bundy, that said that they were willing to stay there for 10 years. That doesn't sound like a 5-minute attack to me. And what was the part of about seizing a worthless visitor center in the middle of nowhere that nobody had ever heard of? You know, ladies and gentlemen, we can keep doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. But what the different things that we've done over and over again, Ruby Ridge, Waco, Texas, the Bundy Ranch, Kearney County, Oregon, Burns, Oregon, and the Maller Bird Refuge. We can start doing things a little differently, maybe studying some of the principles of unconventional warfare and coming to the realization that this coming over here and taking over some worthless, who cares, visitor center out in the middle of nowhere, and then everybody wants to go up there and they have to wait for all the TV cameras and the satellite vehicles and show up. But in the meantime, you're being surrounded. And we've also pointed out in the past of the graduates from the Army War College that have completed that, and now they take a one-year sabbatical to work with the FBI, ATF, the CIA, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So now there's a cross communications between the government branches and the media and the military, and then we start to come to the realization why they are so effective. And so I encourage you to tune into the Micro Effect coming up here on Thursday and Friday in the morning, and where we're expanding on the projection of power. And again, if you want to close your mind off of about Iraq and Afghanistan and why we should be there and natural resources and pipelines and oil and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, then you're missing the whole point. Because it doesn't matter where we are or why we should be there and talking about the Council on Foreign Relations and the Bilderbergs and the Trilateral Commission and blaming everybody, and that does a good part per se of examining maybe some of the players, but we've been hearing people point out the players for 20, 30 years now. And yes, there's the argument about, well, we have to bring the new people up to speed. But there comes a point as to where the long-term listeners get a little tired of this repetition, and it's the same thing over and over again, and expecting a different result. And people would just sit here and describe the dimensions of the septic tank, the problem reaction, the problem reaction, the problem reaction, the problem reaction, and no solution. I try to present you one solution and examining it from a historical perspective, because we can sit here for another 20 years and talk about the Trilateral Commission and the Council on Foreign Relations and the Bilderbergs, and we'll still be in a bigger septic tank than we already are. So it's going to be up to you of doing the same thing over and over again, or tuning into your mind as your primary weapon. Bob Minor, we've heard him discussed here on Liberty Tree Radio and the Micro Effect numerous times. His contact telephone number is 701-251-2365. 701-251-2365. A message will come on, says if you'd like to talk to him directly or purchase a telephone card, and then it'll ask you to enter in the first three letters of his last name, M-I-N, translates out to 646, and you'll have about 10 seconds or so to leave some encouraging words. His mailing address is Robert Miner, M-I-N-E-R, and that's SCCC, 205 6th Street Southeast, Suite 201, Jamestown, North Dakota, 58401. Robert Miner, and the initials Sierra Charlie Charlie Charlie, 205 6th Street Southeast, Suite 201, Jamestown, North Dakota, 58401. Let's see. My email address is altabib762@hotmail.com. Alpha Lima Tango Hotel Alpha Bravo Echo Bravo 762@hotmail.com. Thanks for taking the time to tune in today, helping expand your mind out of the protracted struggle and how it's conducted time, space, and will. willing to give up space to buy time and using that time to raise the political consciousness of the people. Time, space, and will. And thank you for helping keep Liberty Tree Radio on the air. And as always, we send this broadcast out to Lily Grace Antoinette. A couple of border news issues. This first one is from cbp.gov/newsroom. Border Patrol agents arrest four Mexican nationals crammed in a trunk over the weekend, 14 May 2018, Yuma, Arizona. Border Patrol agents assigned to the Interstate 8 immigration checkpoint arrested a United States citizen attempting to smuggle four Mexican nationals. At approximately 10 p.m. on Sunday, the Border Patrol K-9 team referred a 2018 white Chrysler 300 for a secondary inspection after the Border Patrol K-9 alerted. A subsequent search of the vehicle revealed four undocumented Mexican nationals in the trunk of the vehicle, a driver, a 41-year-old female United States citizen from Tecape, California, was arrested for harboring certain aliens. The four Mexican nationals were arrested for improper entry by aliens. Borderlandbeat.com, 15 May 2018, double homicide in CDMX. There's a video here. In the video, we see two subjects descend from a compact red car, one of whom carries a revolver in his hand. The last subject goes to where the doorman of the club was and threatens him. The doorman tries to get the gun, but before he did, he gets shot. The second subject reaches in the car and comes out with a gun. Then he goes to the entrance of the bar, but on his way, crosses the doorman and shoots him. The employee's body falls to the floor, already lifeless. However, in the attack, the second man does not realize that one of the bullets hit his partner, who before getting into the car falls to the ground, bleeding. The aggressor climbs quickly into the car, but realizes that his accomplice is down. He goes back to see his partner on the floor in a pool of blood. He pulls his partner in the vehicle and took him to the Ruben Linero Hospital, where due to his seriousness of his injuries, he died. The video shows another subject approaching, but upon realizing the aggression, he opts to retire quickly. According to the research folder, CIFMI, the origin of the bloody episode was due to an attack inside of the club. And I thought that this was just a border thing along our southern border. CBP.gov/newsroom. Border Patrol, FURA, seized cocaine worth $15.6 million. Arrest two aliens. Aguadilla, Puerto Rico. U.S. Border Patrol and Puerto Rican Police Department, the PRPD, and the Joint Forces for Rapid Action, FURA, agent seized 1,326 pounds, 601 kilos, of cocaine found Monday inside a vessel, arresting two aliens from the Dominican Republic. The estimated value of the seized narcotics is $15.6 million. We work daily with our Stone Garden partner, FURA, to stop smuggling attempts in different locations throughout the island, stated Ramiro Carrillo, Ramey Sector, Chief Border Patrol Agent in Aguadilla. The Fura Maritime Unit encountered a twin-engine 28-foot contender vessel operated by two men near Cabo Rojo, Puerto Rico. Fura requested assistance from Ramey Sector Border Patrol agents after stopping the vessel. Borderlandbeat.com, 15 May 2018, El Jefe, or El Borrega, of CDN, executed in Nuevo León. Raúl Gómez Morena, alias Borrega, or Commander Jefe, was executed in Nuevo León. He was the operational jefe of CDN in Ciudad Victoria and Apodaca, and received direct orders from LZ-40 and Z-42. He appeared wrapped in canvas in the square of San Miguel de Apodaca, Colonia. He had signs of torture and at least 6 bullets in his hands, feet, and neck. The report is there was a package covered with gray canvas in the middle of Hidalgo Street in San Miguel Coronilla yesterday mobilized police from Apodaca. Upon arriving, they found the body of Raul Gomez Moreno, alias Boraga, and designated as the second in command of the CDN. The former ministerial police officer, 44-year-old from Tamaulipas, was identified by his fingerprints. He was executed with 8 bullets and had blows to the face, so it is presumed that he was subject to torture after being kidnapped, according to police investigations. Murderlandbeat.com, 15 May 2018, Los Domaso ordered the murder of Javier Valdez. 10 weeks after the murder of Javier Valdez, 2 of the alleged perpetrators of the crime have been named. On July 28 last year, a protected witness pointed them out after having a conversation in which they allegedly spoke of their involvement in the murder, and that the third person was identified in September through security camera images. Almost a year after the murder, the special prosecutor for crimes against freedom of expression arrested one of the alleged perpetrators, but has yet to execute an arrest warrant against another that is already detained in another offense. According to FEADLE, the witness want to make a statement out of fear because he was being threatened. The witness names 3 suspects, etc., etc., and all the similar sounding names. InsightCrime.org, turf dispute breaks North Brazil gang pact, opening door for PCC. Dated 15 May 2018. 2 of Brazil's most important criminal groups have ended a 3-year truce. Well, it sounds like the end of today's broadcast, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for being with us. Stay tuned to Liberty Tree Radio for some further broadcasts, and make sure that you also tune in to The Micro Effect. And we'll continue this block of instruction up on Thursday and Friday. Thanks for being with us. You be careful, and I'll see you. Well-dressed man.